to say a torso. You know what? A torso. A fucking a torso.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Bottlemen. Today, we are having real plague hours. We are talking COVID in Canada. It's me, Riley, and our guest is Nora Loretto, a journalist, co-host of the Sandy and Nora podcast, and author of Take Back the Fight, Organizing Feminism in the Digital Age. Hi, Nora.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm great.
And it is good to be here to hear about a country that until pretty recently I thought was going to be somewhere I could go to enjoy a better COVID response than the UK, which has been killing record-breaking amounts of its own citizens, especially senior citizens, people of color, et cetera, et cetera. But then I read the episode notes for this, and I was like, oh damn. I fell for the trick that thinking Canada is better is just marketing again. I've fallen for that trick dozens of times, and I'll continue to fall for it again in the future. And boy, did I fall for it now.
Yeah, I also fell for that trick.
Why do we keep falling for this trick?
I don't know, because the pitch is so good, I guess. And you want to believe it. You want to believe that this place is safe and that this government is capable of taking care of its citizens in the way that it projects internationally as like a liberal democracy, you know?
Yeah, it's also as Canadian as maple syrup to just like pretend that we don't suck.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right. We do love to just I think it's because mainly Canada just wants to say we're not the US, mm-hmm. so we don't have any of the same dysfunctions. It's just like, I don't, who would, but like it's, I think you could stack up like Doug Ford and Andrew Cuomo. And the only thing holding Doug Ford back from getting a KD spread like Andrew Cuomo is that Doug Ford does not have enough people.
Mm. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The base isn't big enough.
If you gave Doug Ford access to the New York state health system, I think he could really, really rack up some numbers down there.
Well, Cuomo's like a talented politician, right? Like, let's not even pretend that they're in the same fucking stratosphere. Doug Ford is like just such a dumbass, like an incredibly to the core dumbass. And where his brother was also a dumbass, he was also a clown. And so people mistaked like Doug for being less of a clown, for being less of a dumbass. But no, he's just as much of a dumbass.
He's like an unfunny oaf, you know, yeah. Which is the worst type of oaf. You know, you want your oafs covered in bees because they climbed up a tree to and put their head all the way in a beehive to get the sweet honey out and then fell down and are, you know, like,
yeah,
you're not going to get that out of Doug.
I want to see Beat Takeshi directing Ontario, and I want to see him directing Ontario as an oaf.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm tired of this unfunny oaf nonsense.
Yeah, Ontario has taken the best part of oafdom and flattened it. You know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know, when the pandemic began in early 2020, I think this is what we're talking about. I think there was a sense of cautious optimism here that no matter how bad things got, this social democracy would manage and control the effects of the plague much better than our neighbors to the mm-hmm. south. And while that might be true to some extent, like we have a lower death toll, there hasn't been massive civil unrest, and there's been an attempt to ameliorate the economic suffering in the form of monthly relief checks, no matter how bungled that might have been. I think what COVID has done has been to expose the inability and unwillingness of this particular liberal democracy to deal with a public health crisis in any meaningful way. And Nora, you've been reporting on these systematic failures since the beginning of the pandemic. So today, we want you to take us and our listeners on a trip down the federal and provincial government walk of shame and maybe make like a quick detour right to the media dunce corner.
I like that. Like, the center block of shame.
One of the first things I read from you back in April of 2020 were you started doing reports on conditions at nursing homes in Ontario and Quebec. And you sourced all that information basically independently, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the first things I actually wrote was for the Washington Post in March saying, I'm at least glad that we have public health care in this country. And public health care is a baseline safeguard from mass death when a pandemic comes. And it was really fascinating because governments focused on the healthcare system. They focused on hospitals, on clearing spaces within ICUs, focused on having enough equipment for a rush that never happened, or it didn't happen until the second wave. And right. it was funny to see journalists scratching their head and say, wow, this massive rush, the overwhelming of our health hospital system didn't happen. And what they didn't look for was where within the Canadian healthcare system or outside of the Canadian healthcare system, we would start to see the effects that we've basically seen in places in the world where the health system is private, which, you know, the United States is a very good example of that. And so within long-term care, which looks like public health care, has some elements of public health care built into it, is partly publicly funded, but it's also a private system, and it's a private for-profit system with the biggest operators in this country set up as real estate holding companies. And so it wasn't too surprising that while the hospital system wasn't overburdened, while emergency rooms were not turning people away, while we weren't talking about rationing oxygen until the fall in Alberta, the real dumpster fire, the real horror was within long-term care. And so, yeah, as you said, I've been collecting data because, surprise, surprise, in this hellhole fucking system in Canada, no one was collecting this information, whether it was national journalists or the Public Health Agency of Canada or fucking, I mean, anybody. No one was collecting who was dying where. And so I started to do this nightly, and I've had to do it nightly since. I started on around April 12th. And I've had to do it nightly because if you miss a night, the data disappears. It's just gone unless someone else happened to pick it up and I can find it later on to revise my numbers. And it's just such a good example of how our bureaucratic structures through federalism, right, having a federal government that has the powers of taxation, gives the tax money to the provinces, and then the provinces are expected to do whatever the fuck they're going to do with it. That somehow is like organizing an intelligence system, which we basically have just seen completely fail in the last 11 months.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've seen like radically different approaches to handling this in Quebec, Ontario. You know, you've got the sort of American method in Alberta with Kenny, which backfired completely on him. I'm interested in in this sort of wide dichotomy between provincial responses in Canada as kind of a failure of federalism.
Well, you need to let the provinces determine how they're going to respond to each bit of the pandemic, because that's going to, you know, that's basically a free market. And then whoever has the best idea, then their idea can proliferate across the system. Sorry, I just came from my civics and economics 101 class.
Yes,
and so I'm very excited to share some of these ideas. It's definitely not just a cash grab for, you know, what are essentially, yeah, real estate investment trusts at this point.
Well,
right?
The funny thing about what you just described is it's actually still more sense than we have within our system, right? Like, we have to assume, number one, that federalism was set up to create a colonial nation that could have fast access to land, clear those lands of the people that had inhabited them for time immemorial, and offered quick amounts of money to people on get-rich-quick schemes that were either the railway or grain or tar sands development or mining or whatever, right? That is the reason that Canada looks the way it does today. And so is that the most intelligent way to organize a country when your primary goal is to not have old people who live in residential care die? No, that's not the most intelligent way to do it. And and I think it's really important to come back to the reality that Canada was never set up to take care of the people that live within Canada. It's only been set up to take care of a certain kind of person. And the ableism that has been built into our system, and it's not unique, you know, across Western nations, it's very, very similar. But the ableism that has been built into this system has allowed us to actually like extract profit from the final years of people's lives.
Nora, are you saying that if you don't work for the Hudson's Bay Company, you might be kind of in trouble if the country is facing, say, like a national crisis?
Yeah, well, actually, like even workers at the Bay are getting a fucking not a great deal either, because working at the Bay these days is kind of lonely.
Yeah. I don't think you shouldn't really be working at the Hudson's Bay Company. The best bet is you got to own it. Yeah. You know, I'd say really you got to own it or one of its major suppliers. Working for it's not good enough.
Look, if you're not owning the Hudson's Bay Company, you're not grinding hard enough, you know?
That's right. I had to grind hard for this view, I say as I am frozen to my death looking over the Hudson's Bay. I try to avoid doing too many sort of UK comparisons here as well, right? But we have in the UK, we have a similarly like privatized long-term care system where because we have the Department of Health and Social Care. And unlike in Canada, the government directly or at least semi-directly administers NHS hospitals. It's more complicated than that because it's through a trust system, but it's less. So it's more private than it used to be, but it's less private than Canada. And then the administration is like split between like England and Scotland and so on. Anyway, long-term care, though, is completely privatized, totally privatized. It is, you can own a care home and you employ staff on insecure contracts where their hours change weekly and they don't get benefits and all this stuff. And we also had like a total disaster because of this thing called bed blocking, where there'll be like elderly people in hospitals can't get a place in a long-term care home because it's just not profitable to like build the capacity to hold them. And then what happened was COVID started to spread in the hospitals, and then all of these elderly people were removed from the hospitals into the long-term care homes. And then one of the reasons that England has been such a bloodbath for COVID is because basically COVID was put in the long-term care homes because of this sort of shoddy profit-driven infrastructure.
It's not dissimilar to how it happened in Canada either. Now that the public hospital system, which is the hospital system, there are no private hospitals, has done very well. Comparatively, I mean, I think that any death and multiple deaths are tragedy. But if we compare the two systems, in residential care in this country, more than 15,000 people have died. And in public hospitals, from COVID acquired within a public hospital outbreak, it's fewer than 500 people. Now, the data is not great because it's not reported. So that's like how many I've been able to uncover. But there was a huge problem with do you transfer patients out of long-term care into hospital facilities if they're going to die anyway, which was literally like how people were talking about this in April. Do you transfer people within hospitals to long-term care, which is how it usually works in Canada, that if you have been, you know, let's say you've had a stroke and you can't go home, then there's like work within the hospital system to place you in a local long-term care facility. And sometimes you don't have much choice. Sometimes it's a question of what's open. And if it's a question of what's open, then you might find yourself in a public system, in a public facility, in a private facility, probably private if you're in Ontario, probably public if you're in Quebec. But the lack of harmony between these two systems has allowed long-term care to kind of take on this Frankenstein profit character, regardless of if a specific home that we might be talking about is a private or a public home. And it's also interesting you mentioned the UK, because one of the biggest operators in Canada is a company called Revera. And Revera was a for-profit private residence that was publicly traded. It was then purchased by the Pension Board of Canada. So it's owned by like the federal pension fund. Its directors are appointed by the Prime Minister's office through orders in council. And Revera operates in the United States and in the UK. And researchers in Australia last week were able to do an analysis about Revera's business structure within the UK and found that it is probably, I mean, they're hedging the way that they talk about this so they don't get sued, but it looked very much like the system in the UK had been constructed so that they paid as little tax as possible using different tax shelters across the British Isles. And then the UK, the Australian researchers, they say quite clearly that they chose the UK operations of Revera to do this analysis because they didn't have enough information available for the Canadian or the American operations. So they could only benefit from the fact that there's a bit more information in the UK to even look at this. And so it's just like, wow, you people are fucking ghouls. And I'll just end by saying their elder in chief or chief elder operator is a woman who just turned 100 this past week, who's also a fucking ghoul. And her name is Hazel McCallion.
And her name is Prince Philip.
Well, Hazel McCallion is basically the queen of Mississauga, like of the you know, the worst urban sprawly kind of location in Canada. But that's a whole other discussion.
You know, this conversation about public-private Frankensteins kind of leads me to another thing I wanted to talk about, which is this would have been the perfect time to nationalize some of our country's most beloved pseudo-public-private partnerships. But instead, the Fed decided to rain sweet treats down on the oinking hogs, such as Air Canada, Imperial Oil, and Bell. And I just want to go through some of these treats. I want to describe the... describe the treat. So Air Canada received $492 million in Canadian emergency wage subsidies and recently laid off 1,500 employees. Imperial Oil got $100 million and laid off 200 workers in November. And Bell Canada got $122 million and laid off employees and shuttered profitable radio stations in Vancouver, Winnipeg, and Hamilton while continuing to pay out shareholder dividends. And if you think Bell was being squeezed by the pandemic like you are or your friends are, you'd be wrong, because Bell had $5.2 billion in available liquidity at the end of quarter three. They had a 10% internet revenue growth, 4% growth in year-to-date cash flow from operating activities, and 13.7% free cash flow, which translated to 5% increase in quarter four dividends. So why did Bell need this handout? According to, I don't know. You guys could explain. Maybe Nora, you could explain.
It's so disgusting. I think obviously it's really disgusting. And what I was so scandalized by these numbers, like the net revenue that Bell made last year was something like $2.6 billion. Okay. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's total federal grant is $1.2 billion. Like, Bell is just such a greedy piece of shit company. And them, Air Canada, as you mentioned, like they need to be nationalized. Like, why the fuck are these profits being paid out to shareholders when they easily could be subsidizing anything, fucking anything, put into the federal purse? And you know, especially something like Air Canada, which so many communities rely on, which when you hear about the way that journalists and average people talk about Air Canada in the news, it sounds like it's still public, right? It's like, oh, Air Canada is the only thing getting people to Sydney, Nova Scotia, right? And it's like, well, yeah, fuck, like it's a fucking business. What do you expect? They're gonna fucking fly empty planes there? Like, why the fuck would they? They're a private business, right? But we just can't have a grown-up conversation about nationalization in this country because we're pathetic.
Well, okay, number one, my main problem here is that Bell was paying out a dividend, and paying out dividends is what you do when you're a company and it's like 1927. We're all about endless price growth now. Paying out dividends. They should have taken the money they were going to pay out as dividends and bought Bitcoin and then said they were going to buy Bitcoin. That would have sent the price skyrocketing and the investors would have made far more money. God damn it. Fucking hate Bell for that reason specifically, because it's lame. It's lame to pay a dividend. What are they? That's the most boomer fucking shit you can do. But, you know, I mean, it is completely, you know, unsurprised. I mean, look, it's the thing, right, where if you're going to have, like, a, let's say, a historical materialist analysis of the market, especially of the labor market and then the stock market, which are kind of talking about the intersection of the two here, right? Which is, you know, massive federal grants go out. They end up going to the investors before the people actually doing any of the stuff, who are actually going to use that to buy, you know, useless fripperies like food and rent. Of course they're going to chase those returns on capital because the government's basically giving them free money and expecting them to just, you know, essentially, do something good with it.
Yeah, be moral and allocate it properly, you know, and just
I think according to Canadian liberals, they would say it would be irresponsible of us to allocate this to anyone but a monopolist because a monopolist is so good at their job. That's how they became a monopolist. or, in this case, an oligopolist.
Their excuse for this is that they needed the money to roll out 5G and to lay fiber optic cable and for investment capital. That was their big excuse when they were pressed on this.
So they're going to use what, like public money to lay out 5G, which they'll then charge like $100 a megabyte for. It's been a long time since I've paid for data in Canada, but that's what I remember it being.
See, if we were a real country, we would nationalize Bell as part of our war against China.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's totally incoherent. That's right.
even the Hawks want to nationalize Bell. It's the classic thing, right? Of us having sort of such a high level of complacency. I think, you know, if there's one thing that I think we keep running into over and over and over again in the last kind of five episodes, including this one, it is the just intense complacency in the face of mounting and growing crises. You know, like looking at, because like even then before COVID, there is a crisis level oligopoly in Canadian telecom. And where there was an opportunity with like the political capital to be an activist in an entrepreneurial state, what the Canadian government does is essentially gives them a no strings attached loan that they then redistribute to their shareholders in the lamest way possible.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the question of complacency is very interesting, and it ties into something that we'll talk about in a bit, but like the quality of commentary, analysis, and news in this country is what leads to that, right? Like, it's actually really complicated to understand, like, first of all, one, that Bell Canada is not a fucking public corporation anymore, right? Like, a lot of people still have that hangover, that Air Canada is no longer a public corporation, that, Air Canada has stolen money from how many of us? I mean, I'm fucking still out $600 from them. And, like, no one's... set a plane on fire or showed up at Callan Rovinescu's door and been like, yo, where's my $600? But it's because like all of this stuff is just so massaged to be normal. And any voice that questions the orthodoxy of the Canadian economy, of Canadian society, of Canadian politics are routinely sidelined, and not like just sidelined, but like fucking, you know, attacked, damaged, disparaged, ignored,
punished, really
super punished, right? And it's like, you know, as someone who knows that really fucking well, it's just like I understand to an extent some of that complacency. And then you look at something like the difference between the culture of fighting back in Ontario versus the culture of fighting back in Quebec. And I certainly, like, at least in Quebec, as bad as it gets in Quebec, I know that there's a breaking point where people will start setting shit on fire. And I'm like at least comforted by that, because in Ontario, there is no breaking point for when people will start setting shit on fire. And I think actually that kind of culture is very similar right across the West, the rest of the West of the country.
Yeah, I totally agree. Having grown up in British Columbia and now living in Quebec, there is definitely still some kind of limit to how much you could fuck around with people here. But in a place like Vancouver Island or, you know, Vancouver, there is no limit. You can push real estate prices to the point where, you know, someone who is a professor at UBC has to have 3 roommates just to live in a shitty condo. So here I feel like there definitely is more of a collective, like you were saying, collective breaking point. But I want to talk about who is manufacturing this. This the consent to accept the normalization of all of this complacency.
The easiest answer would be like post media, right? And that would be, I think, what people, a lot of people would reach to the fastest. But I actually think that this is at the foot of the public broadcaster. I think that the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation is the real culprit of sanitization, of marginalization, of disparaging views that are unorthodox, to the point where if you listen to some of the programming from the 1960s, it sounds like fucking actually more radical than today, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, Malcolm X being on Front Page Challenge, there's no corollary to Malcolm X being on Front Page Challenge to any fucking show or personality today.
Nora, are you saying that the CBC having Marcus Kolga from the McDonald Laurier Institute sort of rinsing Latvian defense ministry talking points in an attempt to manufacture consent in Canadians to put our military on the Russian border is not the same as Malcolm X?
There's a bit of sunlight between those two things. But hey, Dan, how many times do you think the Canadian Federation of Independent Business was quoted in the first 9 months of the pandemic?
Oh, fuck
me. I'm going to say the over is... The question is, what's the over under on them getting quoted versus a Banderite?
Oh no, I mean, like let's just get the ballpark of this figure first, and then we can talk about all the fucking like ones that that this completely dwarfs.
Just as an aside, Riley, would you be surprised to know that a Banderite was who's in charge of pandemic economic recovery was in talks with this organization?
I was joking. It's not supposed to be true. That's insane. We just can't. We love Banderites in Canada.
We love them. Politico published this absolutely just puff piece on Chrystia Freeland and her appointment to economic recovery czar. And and as a positive, they
czar is right.
They yeah, exactly. As a positive, they were like, "It's great. She's talking to the CFIB." It was the first person, the first people she's in touch with for economic recovery. Nora, do you want to explain what this organization is and then give us the numbers?
Sure. I would love for you to try to guess because it's just like unbelievable. But the Canadian Federation of Independent Business.
Okay, I'm going to say five.
No, it's not five. What the fuck?
Five times. Okay, I'm going to do closest without going
no,
over.
No, come on. You
got to
fucking
rules,
guess
six.
For real.
Okay. All right.
Just pick a number.
The thing is, okay, I'm thinking in my metagame. I'm metagaming a little bit here. Okay, I'm going to go 90.
No, fuck. No.
Wait, is this, sorry, is this in one article or in over the course of the pandemic?
Over the course of 9 months.
Over the course of 9 months? Okay. Okay. 15.
No.
I don't even
so
know.
So much
what's
higher.
Reasonable.
So fucking much higher. I mean,
okay,
so this
over
is.
Over 100.
More. So I'll 500? Explain who they are. This is an organization that was founded in the 1960s when a guy was taking a bath and he was in his bath and like, honest to God, this is on their website. And he was like, taxes are fucking getting me down. And how am I going to organize a front group to fucking fight taxes? And so he founded the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. And so they've got like a federated structure. So they've got provincial representation, like a national board. And their only job is to fucking fight for the little guy, right? The real true Canadian spirit of fucking small business. And so they have been one of the principal commentators and offering analysis within this pandemic, but also a very critical person who's been driving the Liberal policy, the fucking NDP policy, and the fucking Conservative policy. So a guy, an organization and a guy, the President Dan Kelly, with that kind of power, how many times do you think he'd be quoted in the press?
Okay, I've made my guesses. Dan, what do you think?
I'm gonna say 110. I'm gonna hedge my bets.
Oh my God, guys, no, 70,000 times.
What?
Holy shit!
Excuse me.
No, like it doesn't make any sense. 70 fucking thousand media citations of the CFIB.
Would you? I mean, okay. Admittedly, I have over the course of last year just been learning about the CFIB mostly through my friend Arlen, drummer for Wolf Parade. And when you go to their landing site, one of the first things you see is an FAQ on how to bust unions.
Yeah.
And it's like they're not even hiding it behind rhetoric or language. It is just literally like, do you have a union problem at your small business? Here's how to squash it. Here's how to stop it. So 70,000 citations.
Jesus. Well, I'm glad they're in charge.
Yeah, 70,000. And part of the way that they've managed to do this, I mean, part of it is their politics for sure. Part of it is because journalists are lazy as fuck. And so what they were doing throughout the course of the pandemic was that they just kept on surveying their members. And then they weekly would send out a new small business survey. Small business owners are saying this. Small businesses, fucking 90% of small businesses are going to close by the end of this pandemic. And that formed the basis of understanding this pandemic through the eyes of small business. And yeah. I'm writing a book right now. And so this is like part of what I'm writing about, which is why I fucking even know that stat. Like normally I fucking would not. But this has been critical to transforming our collective understanding of business to be a fucking small paper shop, a florist, a gym, a fucking coffee shop, right? And not the Amazon's, Walmart's, fucking Canadian Tire's shipping and distribution factories, fucking all the tar sands operations and mines that are actually driving COVID spread within this country. And that has been completely absent because you're fucking talking to Dan Kelly 70 fucking thousand times.
Are you telling me that the small businesses that are the backbone of our country and our economy might not have everyone's best? Come on, that's pretty ridiculous. I checked the National Post, and they said that small businesses were going to be the key to the recovery, and that it doesn't. And then, you know, the best way to prevent a unionization drive is if everyone is dead from COVID.
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
I mean, rinsing these points has been really a full court press by our media, like both on the left and on the right. I mean, for whatever you can say, we have a left wing media here. I guess I'm talking more a liberal center. But, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, I think one of the biggest offenders were just like targeted op-ed pieces. And I'm thinking specifically about an article by a guy who I still don't believe actually exists. Max Fawcett is
Maximum Fawcett.
Maximum Fawcett. Yeah, I'm not sure what this person does, how they make money, or if they are even real. The entity known as Max Fawcett published an article on April 3rd in Maclean's magazine, April 3rd, 2020, titled "Doug Ford's Surprising Turn." He said, when coronavirus first appeared in Canada and Ford encouraged people to continue with their spring break plans, it looked as though he would make a predictable hash of his province's response. But then, as if by magic, the combative and error-prone premier was replaced by a different Doug Ford, one who projected an unmistakable air of calm, competence, and decency, and then goes on to compare him to Winston Churchill at the end of the article. Now, whatever Max Fawcett is,
I mean, again,
he will not be punished. It will not be punished. The entity known as Max Fawcett will continue to fucking make money by publishing whatever garbage it comes up with, you know? And basically what I'm saying is no one who had a terrible take at the beginning of this is going to be punished for it. We are going to continue reading articles by these people. And they're sort of complicit. Complacency and them being complicit in the managing of the public perception of the government's response to this pandemic will never be challenged.
Although I think that the comparison of Doug Ford to Winston Churchill is apt, as both of them did sort of look at populations under their care and just decide a number of you are expendable.
Yes, but counterpoint, I don't think Doug Ford was born on a bathroom floor.
Doug Ford was born on a bathroom floor. He was born on a Kelsey's bathroom floor.
Right, of course. That fucking egg sandwich love goes very deep. No one's going to get punished for this stuff. And it's because they all serve a very important purpose. I mean, Fawcett's now a columnist at the National Observer, which is a place that I had been a columnist for 3 years and where I lost my column because of COVID because they said they couldn't pay me. And then they didn't call me back when they got money for Fawcett. So, you know, the money that he's going to make there is not going to be much. But it's his brand of small C conservative, big L liberal is very popular because it is the exact kind of reassuring, status quo maintaining drivel that confuses people, right? That like saying that Doug Ford was good actually in April was like, what the, based on fucking what? What the fuck? Like, you're fucking literally inventing something right now. There's, he hasn't done anything for you to say that he's good. And in doing nothing, all we have he's either neutral or he's bad, right? Like, you cannot say he's fucking good. And then of course, now look, like, Ontario did not do anything to protect against the second wave, and the second wave killed far more people than the first wave, and we're only now seeing Ontario get out of that that period of time. But even in that, in their getting out of it right now, I mean, cases have still not dropped, and like, I've got fucking friends going to the gym and stuff in Ontario. It's like, oh my god, what the fuck.
I went to that Max Fawcett piece, and I have a line from it I want to share.
Yes, please.
Which I think is so cool. So we talked about, right, of how Ford, as if by magic, you know, the magic of the consent manufacturing machine, became a good leader who I like personally. And again, the magic isn't that he did anything different. The magic is that Maximum Fawcett, felt slightly unsafe and looked for a big, politics daddy to maintain that sense of safety. So here's the quote from the article, which I think is hilarious at how absolutely just jangling keys it takes to impress this guy. As if by magic, the combative, error-prone premier was replaced by a different Doug Ford, one who projected an unmistakable air of calm, competence, and decency. Again, something that makes me feel good. I, a columnist, politics should be based around making columnists feel nice. His praised his federal partners for their work and made it clear they were in this together. And when a reporter served up an opportunity on Monday for him to spike the political volleyball back in Ottawa's court by asking about the immediate increase in the federal carbon tax, he let it drop, instead calling Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland an absolute champion.
Absolute champ.
Wow. Thank you. That's worth all the deaths, Doug. Cool.
Chrystia Freeland's an absolute fucking champ. You're just like, guys, shut up.
Yeah, again, just a guy whose brain has just been liquefied by bad mayonnaise, just like trying his best. But here's the, this is, that's not the good paragraph. This is the good paragraph. But that's not all. Wait, are you saying that there was more to this than just I felt good because he said something nice about the Liberal government? I mean, look, this is, if you listen to our premium episode about the life and career of David Frum, you'll know that like the point of conservative liberals basically is to like basically is the point of conservative liberals is to like praise the furthest right of the center from the right. And so like, you know, like Maximum Fawcett being like, wow, this like Doug Ford, buck a beer, Doug Ford praised Chrystia Freeland. This is incredible. This is like the end of World War II. Damn. But that wasn't all. So this is what he's impressed by even more. When Ford, who is famous for fielding phone calls from constituents against the advice of his political staff, got wind that an Ontario medical supply company was donating 90,000 masks to hospitals in the province, he personally drove over to their warehouse in Markham and loaded them onto his truck and didn't even tell anyone. Well, how the fuck did you find out about it, Max? MM?
Well, but actually, and there's something very funny in what you just read. Doug Ford was not famous for taking calls from constituents. That was Rob Ford. Rob Ford was famous for doing that and got in a lot of trouble for it because he would take people's calls at all hours of the day and when he was driving. And so people took pictures of him on the phone while he was driving talking to constituents. So good work, Max. That's not wrong fucking Ford. The one you're talking about is dead.
And while nobody is going to mistake Ford for a fiscal spendthrift, he pulled the reins on his government's effort to cut costs in the public sector. And again, like, yeah, like, fine. Like, yeah, don't, like, actively fire public employees while this is going on.
Well, Jason Kenney's managing
really
to do that.
Pardon me?
Jason Kenney has been doing that. And that's the purpose of Fawcett, right? Fawcett's an Alberta-based writer. Yeah. And he's trying to show conservatives in Alberta that there is a different way forward than the absolutely depraved politics of someone like Jason fucking Kenney.
Mm. Well, I think it might then be worth moving on from, you know, again, this Just this absolute imbecile being fascinated by some like jingling keys on TV to Jason Kenney in the Alberta response. Because, yeah, he's just like, he basically gave oil companies a bunch of money and then, he seems to basically be governing like a sort of like Carl Icahn governs a company, which is like he would take it over and then just reroute the pensions into his Cayman Islands bank account, with the exception that instead, Jason Kenney isn't rerouting the isn't rerouting all the public money into his own bank account. He's rerouting it into an oil company, but he's still firing all the employees anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, that seems good.
Jason Kenney's, I think one of the things that summed up the agony of Jason Kenney for me the most during this pandemic is his just impassioned speech to his electorate a couple of weeks ago, where he is literally just begging them to do the thing that his government has told them not to do, which is listen to the government.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Kenny is such a piece of shit, and that was really solidified in my mind. I mean, obviously, always, but in the last couple of weeks, rapid tests have become very popular for politicians to promise, and nowhere in Canada have rapid tests really been used very well, other than maybe in some parts of the Maritimes and in some long-term care facilities in British Columbia. And so, you know, Kenny has pressure on him to use rapid tests within long-term care and within schools. And there was this little note that was like, but he did make available 7,000 rapid tests for the tar sands company doing this so that their workers can be tested twice a week. And it's just like the corruption is so deep, and it's all hands on deck to make sure that nothing stops within manufacturing, food processing, and resource extraction. While at the same time, you have a situation like the Olymel meat processing facility in Red Deer, where at least one worker has died, hundreds of workers have become infected with COVID, and they're just absolutely refusing to put the brakes on that facility. I think that only this week, after 3 weeks of a massive outbreak and of a worker's death, is Olymel finally saying, okay, maybe we'll stop, maybe we'll shut it down.
Well, Lita, let's make sure we quote the CFIB on this as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, they are literally quoted in articles like this, if you can fucking believe it. Like, in any single article that has the word business on it, and across almost all of the national platforms, CBC, I find, is the absolute worst for this, but CTV and Global are not far behind. The CFIB is fucking in there, and it's like, why? What the fuck do you have to add to this? Like, fucking, well, Dan Kelly?
Just one day ago, in fact, the CFIB was quoted in an article on CBC.ca, Alberta adds $120 million in pandemic support for struggling business. The CFIB is quoted saying that 57% of hospitality businesses and 44% in arts and recreation say they're actively considering closing. Small businesses are still hanging on by a very thin thread right now, and they do need all the additional support they can get. So I'm really glad to know, you know, that we're getting CFIB numbers in our basically a manufacturing consent for our giveaway to capital. Businesses like the oil sands, for example.
The CFIB was critical to the creation of the wage subsidy, the CEWS. And the wage subsidy is where Bell and Air Canada and Rogers and Chorus, all of these fucking corporations, got most of their federal money from. And you know, I collect the wage subsidy for my little tiny organization. We've got two part-time salaries, and I know how little information they ask of us. It's really shocking. And so the original requirement of the wage subsidy was that you had to demonstrate that you had at least 30% of your income impacted by the pandemic. So you would compare, like, you know, your income from this month to maybe 2019 or to the previous 3 months, which was the two options that they did it. And the CFIB lobbied hard to even drop that, that we had to prove that we lost any money at all. Like, they're just so, like, this is where I get very frustrated with the left, right? Like, have no shame. Maybe we should have fucking less shame. And maybe we should be fighting for stuff that seems completely ridiculous, because the right has no fucking problem doing it. And the right has no shame. They have absolutely no problem saying that they're fighting for the little guy while literally handing over the largest amounts of money to Imperial Oil and to fucking Extendicare, which is the largest operator of long-term care facilities in this country, so that they could pay out shareholders while hundreds of people died within their fucking care. It's so It's just so Canadian, right? It goes back to that thing that we said at the beginning of how this is absolutely to the core of what Canada is. Canada is a get rich quick scheme. That's all this country is. And the first person I saw say that was Jane Jacobs. That she really? So well articulated in the 1970s that Canadian economic expansion, Canada's economy and plans around it is literally in the pursuit of get rich quick schemes, and everything goes back to that mentality.
Yeah, because it's all just stuff you can get for free. And so of course, you know, we're gonna get of course we're gonna like look at or at least like Canadian capital is going to look at COVID and see it through the lens of a get rich quick scheme. And the only reason that the federal and provincial governments really exist is to facilitate these get rich quick schemes. And, you know, I think it goes to show as well, right? Like, you shouldn't be surprised that they're all of, even at the federal level, the programs designed were just so like shitty and full of gaps. Like, I personally know a bunch of like students and recent graduates who have been completely missed by CERB, for example. You know, just people who are like, the government of Canada is just like, yeah, sorry, I know you did graduate recently, but you know, you weren't at university after like, you know, noon on the 3rd of November of last year, so I'm afraid you no longer qualify, even though someone who was like, you know, went and shook the dean's hand 10 minutes later might. You know, it is just so just hasty and shitty and just clodged together.
The first several months of the pandemic, I'd say the first 8 months of the pandemic, I did not qualify for CERB, and CRB wasn't implemented yet because I'm technically, self-employed as a musician. But I had, I'd say 90% of my income just annihilated. And burned through my savings, just keeping the lights on, and then finally got a Patreon up and running. and until CRB hit, that's basically what saved me. And the fact that I had a little money put away. But a lot of my friends who are also musicians or people who work on the technical side, you know, people who do front of house, people who are techs, there was nothing for them. It was just a wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but what if they were Bell shareholders?
Well, I mean,
you know, and the relief money just comes through Bell.
Exactly.
That's how we're distributing that to all of these techs in front of house people, is we're just going to be like, look, you should have owned Bell.
Yeah, every day I get up and I fucking kick myself that I didn't grind hard enough to be a Bell shareholder. You know, where did my life go wrong?
The most ridiculous thing, too, is that the biggest emphasis on aid was actually through the wage subsidy. It wasn't supposed to be through CERB. And so, like, the mentality of the federal government, which was supported by all the fucking parties, including the NDP, was that those front of house folks, those techs, they would still be employed by venues. That they would still be employed by venues, they would have nothing to do, and that they would receive their aid through a wage subsidy that their employer had the time to apply for and to distribute through a salary. Right? Like, that was Canada's fucking plan. And CERB was for everybody who just couldn't avoid getting laid off. And then, of course, there's a lot of people caught in between, not like having been laid off in the middle of the pandemic and not eligible for CERB. But that just tells you everything about the Liberals' mentality. At the same time, that people who made less than $5,000 in 2019 got literally fuck all. They got nothing. Unless there's someone that lives with a disability, and then maybe they got a one-time payment of $600. And so, you know, it's again, built into Canada's this aggressive social stratification that the vast majority of the media establishment never sees. They don't experience personally. They certainly don't live it. And so, you know, I saw someone today saying that they were very excited to see that her friend, who's like in her 50s, was getting a vaccine in the UK because the vaccines are, you know, being distributed well in the UK. And someone responded saying, yes, but the deaths in the UK were so much worse. It's just nice to see that, you know, people that lived through that got the vaccine. But it's like, sorry, the deaths in Canada were fucking just as bad, depending on who you are or where you live. Like, I was getting texts all morning from a friend of mine who's very small reserve community in northern central Canada, I'm not going to say where, has lost 8 elders from the pandemic in a tiny, tiny community. So, you know, this stuff isn't equal, as nothing is equal in this country. And it's enraging that the politicians continue to just perpetuate that inequality.
Yeah, there's an unequal distribution of suffering during this. And I feel like if that doesn't radicalize people in this country, then I don't know what will.
It's also right. I think we could go back to sort of a question we were kind of kicking around a little bit at the beginning, which is that in order for people to be affected by this, for it to change their, for them to gain a more radical politics from this, they'll need to know about it. You know, they're going to need to see it reported somewhere. They're going to have to come into contact with this information. And it seems like the entire setup of the Canadian media is such that they're going to come into they're going to see what the CFIB says. They're not going to see these. And like you said, Nora, at the beginning, like, no one's tracking these numbers. No one's looking at it. No one's really interested.
You are. Sorry,
yeah. One person is tracking these numbers. Yeah. And so, like, what I do know is that, and I especially know this from the experience of the last 5 years in the UK, is that it is fucking hard to, even if all of the material conditions are around you, if all of them are there, the abject failure of the, like, sort of liberal democratic state as it is constituted to tackle these problems, it's all there if you look for it. But the problem is that what is actually happening will be very, very easily and effortlessly drowned out by ideology.
Yes.
Will be very, very easily and effortlessly sort of, because if it's not on the front page of the Globe and Mail, it's very hard to get people to see it, right?
Like, kind of, but you know, there's a couple of assumptions built in what you've both just said. Like, so number one, people do not radicalize simply because their conditions are shitty, right? People radicalize because they're organized. And that's where we have to really look at the left and see how in shambles leftist organizing is in this country. One of the things that I've learned through doing Sandy and Nora, my podcast, and, you know, we're coming up on year four, actually, of Sandy and Nora, has been that we have managed to radicalize a lot of people through doing our own media. And so I'm very glad to see that you folks are doing a podcast too in a similar way, that there are ways to educate, to bring people together, to do online experiences like teach-ins and to do real work, real life, you know, with study groups and all this kind of stuff that people are engaged in right now. And that is how we radicalize people, right? We just cannot expect them to just spontaneously understand the stuff finally because they're so fucking poor that they're, you know, freezing in their house in Texas because of a fucking snowstorm that came out of nowhere, right? Like that's just not how radicalization happens. And unfortunately, what passes for the left in this country is very small, isolated groups that on their own are probably, some are doing like absolutely critical work and admirable work, but there's no, we just have, it's been a generation of activism that has gone by where we have absolutely no national location for us to have some sort of radical intervention within the federal government. And I'm not talking about partisan interventions. I've got quite a lot of, you know, criticisms of focusing on partisan interventions, but social movements are just completely fucked right now.
Right.
Well, yeah, I think, and it goes back to that thing we were talking about of complacency. It comes back to this idea, almost like it's the same thing that the sort of liberal conservative or the conservative liberal does, which is point to everything that's much worse and say, well, at least I'm not that. So if I ever get to that, then I'll know I have to do something. I'll have to organize whatever. But the thing is, by the time you get to that stage, your comparator is already further along. So you're on the same track. You're going in the same direction. The same things are happening to you. But because it always feels like it could be worse, it's very, very difficult to create that kind of class consciousness because, well, it's just, there is that sort of scent, this smog of complacency that has just sort of settled in. And it's not to say that it's impenetrable. Certainly not. But my goodness, it does seem like an uphill battle. But, you know, that's what it is to be on the left. It's that it's the myth of Sisyphus, but, you know, about Canadian organizing.
I think what we've been talking about here is how, you know, COVID has exposed a government that has given away its ability to govern where it counts, to mobilize a response and inspire beneficial collective action like, say, New Zealand or Vietnam. And a population that has just been brain poisoned into being ungovernable and unmovable. And I think it's exposed the limits of the politics of individualism and the limits of federalism as a as a way to respond to any kind of serious or meaningful crisis.
Yeah, it's that's a big message for me as well. I mean, I've been writing about federalism being shit for so long. I mean, I pitched an article about how federalism needs to end to the National Post's comment section when Jen Gerson was the editor. And it was just this funny, like, oh, I don't know if we can run that. And of course, they fucking didn't. I think I probably had it published by Briar Patch magazine in the end. But it is true. And, you know, we are in a time as well of accelerated change. And that change on the other side can be more vicious and more right wing and more brutal. Or it could be not that. It could be what we managed to fight to make it. And I mean, I'm optimistic in some cases. I'm super pessimistic in other cases. But if anything, any doubt that existed before this pandemic that Canada is completely fucking shit should be gone in people's minds. And I feel like from a rhetorical perspective, from a perspective of using using this moment as pedagogy, I think is great. I think that it will actually create new kinds of left-wing organizing in this country that I cannot wait to be part of and to witness.
Same. I agree.
And I can't wait to see it from over here.
Well, thanks for joining us, Nora, and thanks for sort of outlining all of these failures. Do you have anything you want to plug?
I guess people should probably buy my book because, surprise, surprise, I haven't had a single national journalist write about it. I wrote this book on feminism and basically explaining what organizing needs to look like or what it does look like or what it should look like. And it's while it's about feminism, you can pretty much plug any social movement tendency or ideology into the word for feminism and you get the same results. And so you can get the book. It's called Take Back the Fight from any bookstore in Canada and outside of Canada. You can get it as well. It's published by Fernwood or Columbia University Press. And I forget who's got it in the UK, but you can get it there too.
All right.
Fantastic. So thank you again for listening to this free episode of The Bottleman. Do not forget, we have a bonus episode this week with Jesse Hawken of the Junk Filter Pod, where we are talking about some a near future movie set somewhere that the CFIB I'm sure would like. We are talking about the Netflix draws pick Outside the Wire, which depicts a near future dystopia of a Ukraine riven by war. So we will be talking about all of the nonsense there. So do tune in for that. $5 a month, you know what the deal is. In the meantime, we'll see those of you sort of are savvy enough investors to be on the Patreon in a few days, and we will see the rest of you about a week from now. Later.